we should get started. And we're going to leave the door open because we have heard that the train from Helsinki is running late, so people will be coming late. Okay, so according to feminist scholar Donna Haraway, we have never been human in the humanist sense, but our humanness has always been a complicated mesh of connections between us and different kinds of non-humans. How then should we define our humanity in this changing web of connections and interactions with the non-human? This is what our two-day seminar, Reconfiguring Human and Non-Human, Text, Images and Beyond, sets to find out. My name is Maija-Kaisa Poistinen, and as the chair of the organizing committee, I would like to welcome you all here today on behalf of our whole team. When we started planning this seminar, we were expecting it to be a very small event of not more than 20 or 30 participants. However, as paper proposals started arriving from all over the world, our little project grew a bit bigger. I am happy to say that we have almost 70 registered guests, including presenters from 15 different countries on four continents. In addition to our two keynote lectures, we have 39 papers ranging from the representations of alien creatures in science fiction to the possibilities of posthumanist literature, and from the practices of othering in the media to the negotiations of eco-criticism in the visual arts. Why then did our small seminar attract more interest than we had expected? Haraway has not been alone to a criticism of certain aspects of humanist thought. In recent years, scholars of different fields have increasingly turned their gaze towards the complex negotiations between humans and non-humans. Theorists and thinkers of eco-criticism, animal ethics, queer studies, disability studies, feminist theory, and numerous other disciplines have challenged the humanist notions that place certain kinds of human beings above all other creatures. In the liberal humanist tradition, the idea of humanity has indeed often excluded different groups of people, including, for instance, women. Therefore, many scholars have opted for a sort of post-humanism that questions the anthropocentric or human-centered views of humanist thought. One thing that might have contributed to this increase of interest is that we are now living in the time of the Anthropocene, meaning that our human influence on the world is now more significant than ever before. Thus, we need to ask what we humans are truly doing to our Earth and the creatures inhabiting it, including ourselves. How could we create more sustainable living conditions for both humans and non-humans so that we might continue sharing this Earth together also in the future? In the meantime, our material human existence has also been reconfigured by the Human Genome Project, in vitro meat, custom-made pharmacology, bioart, and other scientific and technological developments. Consequently, redefinitions and reimaginations of humans and non-humans have gained new emphasis in cultural studies, as have the complex material social entanglements of the production and reception of art and media. Not only scholars, but artists as well, have taken keener interest in the non-human, which will also be indicated by some of the papers presented in this seminar. In addition to the Anthropocene and the different scientific and technological developments mentioned above, there is another aspect in today's cultural landscape that demands the redefining of human and non-human. and technological developments which now enable waging war with the help of unpiloted drones, immigration, and the issues considering human rights, also makes one wonder who ultimately is considered the right kind of human and who is not. Lately, here in Finland, the discussions dealing with, for example, immigration and the legalization of same-sex marriage have shown us the importance of studying how certain groups of people are dehumanized in cultural discussions and what kinds of consequences this may have. This sort of dehumanization also makes visible how the devaluing of specific human lives is connected to the way we devalue all non-human entities. Therefore, we could not be more happy that we grew into this international event and were able to gather this many scholars and artists to ask the questions we need to focus on in this time of the Anthropocene: technological warfare, species extinction, and vast immigration movements. These questions include: how are humans and non-humans represented, reimagined, or indeed remade across arts and media, and what political and ethical implications do cultural texts and images of human and non-human embodiments have? How are art and media productions created in the complex material social relations that encompass the spheres of both human and non-human? Is it possible to step outside our limited anthropocentric perspectives by creating or engaging with human and non-human characters in fiction? A few words from the Vice Chair of the Organizing Committee, Essi Valis.
Thank you. As Anna-Kaisa said, the response to this little seminar of ours has been very enthusiastic and quite global, which has come as a pleasant surprise to us all. It's not what we conspire to find the hottest, most thought-provoking, most current subjects that lie in the intersection of as many artistic and academic fields as possible. Rather, the hatching of this project had every appearance of a coincidence, but then doesn't everything before the benefit of hindsight. During the past year, our home department, Department of Art and Culture Studies, has been mapping its research clusters or identifying its core areas of interest. This turned out to include such interesting topics as art and mind, limits of art, and media culture. It all worked out just fine until late this spring I realized that a few very important connections might have been noticed. In the meantime, our literature professor Sanna Karkulehto, who is sitting over there, had also discovered that more and more of her advisees, undergraduates, graduates, and postdoctorals alike, were becoming interested in posthumanism and other such fields that explore the quasi manifold borders we draw between humans and other creatures. Indeed, Anna-Kaisa, Sanna's advisee, defended her doctoral dissertation about the reimagining of gender and humanity just this spring. She continues her inquiry into the connections between feminist theory, posthumanism, and popular culture in her postdoctoral research. Since one of the original presenters cancelled, Anna-Kaisa will be telling you more about her interests in our first paper session today. Hetta Mattinen also completed her doctorate only a month ago. Her narratological study of weird Scandinavian autofictions relates to something called a natural narratology. This new branch of literary studies has recently questioned the core idea of natural narratology, that all narratives are focused on human experience and modeled after natural human discourse. Despite her affiliations with a natural narratology, Heta is also interested in the natural usage of language. As for myself, I am investigating the cognitive understanding of comic book characters. The object of my graduate studies is to explain how our minds transform the simple lines on paper into possible fellow creatures. This includes analyzing the ways comics, and only comics, can represent humanity while also granting identifiable human qualities to very weird, very unhuman creatures. Tanja Välisalo, on the other hand, researches how people in furry fandom are creating anthropomorphic animal characters or avatars in order to explore and express their identities. Like my research, Tanja's research relates the boundary the ways human and non-human qualities tend to get mixed in fictional and virtual characters. Heidi Kosonen is also at the visual end of our spectrum. Her doctoral research focuses on socio-cultural structure of taboo in contemporary visual culture. Taboos are instrumental in constructing otherness, which on the other hand is closely connected to what humanness, especially humanness, could, should be. You can, by the way, recognize as organizers by these blue banners on our name tags. If you have any questions or need something, you can just come and ask us. Some other people might have looked at this medley through and seen no common denominator whatsoever. We all research even media, and our majors vary from literature and art history to contemporary culture. We, however, had an intuition that something resonated between all of our research projects. And over a course of one extended lunch hour, we understood that we are all, in one way or another, treading the odd borderlands of humanity. For better or for worse, there is much to humanity. It's a complex subject that can only be comprehended by triangulating it from several dozens, if not several hundreds, of points of view. Humanity, however, is nothing compared to what lies beyond it. What is the opposite of human has so many possible answers. There is an even vaster, even more complex universe discovered beyond our limited human perspective, which we, sadly, can only admire, fear, and analyze through the very same limited human perspective of ours. How frustrating. After recognizing the limitations of human capabilities, as post-humanist philosophy has done, we can, however, start to look for the cure. And if there is something that can make the limits of our perspective less restrictive, or at least more obvious, it is art, and science, and the combinations of the two, especially the combinations of the two, many kinds of combinations of the two, which is why you are all here, and which is why we are happy that you represent so many different disciplines and look at humanity in so many interesting ways. We bid you all welcome to the University of Jyväskylä, and hope that the next 2 days will stimulate and broaden all of our minds.
Thank you, Liz. Now I would like to welcome our first keynote speaker, Dr. Robert McKay from the University of Sheffield. McKay is a teacher of literature, film and critical theory who has published widely on the politics of species in post-war and contemporary literature and film. For example, the interdisciplinary collection Killing Animals, written with the Animal Studies Group, was published in 2006. Furthermore, McKay is a series co-editor of Palgrave Studies in Animals and Literature and associate editor of Society and Animals. His current projects include an edited collection called Wolves, Werewolves and the Gothic, and he is also one of the editors of a book called Animal Form, 500 of Feudal Fictions Against Value in the Arts and Education that will be published in 2016. Today we will be talking about Michel Faber's novel Art the Scheme.
And a brief expert commentary on Dr. McKay's lecture will be given by our friend and colleague Kaisa Rautakallio from the University of Helsinki. Kaisa is currently working on her doctoral dissertation, which concerns the reimagining of human subjectivity in post-humanist philosophy and allophonic science fiction literature. She is especially interested in the material and ecological aspects of post-humanist project and the trope of the mutant. Kaisa is also the secretary of FinFor, the Finnish Society for Science Fiction and Fantasy Research. Thank you very much, both of you, for coming, and we should have some time for audience questions after Kaisa's commentary. But for the next hour, the floor is yours.
Cool. Okay, my talk's called The Meat That Therefore I Am, Rewriting Anthropocentrism in Michelle Faber's Under the Skin. One of the persistent hopes, fantasies you might say, of the animal rights movement has been that only if people could only see, if only they could be made properly to visualise the reality of animal slaughter for meat, they would recognise it for the industrial scale violence and suffering that it truly is. And so they would turn away from anthropocentric modes of eating to vegetarianism or even eventually to veganism. The current apotheosis of this idea can perhaps be found in a video sponsored by People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals on www.meat.org. Its voiceover begins, I hope that they have an impersonation. Hi, I'm Paul McCartney. I've often said that if slaughterhouses had glass walls, everyone would be vegetarian. And it continues, I hope that once you see the routine cruelty involved in raising, transporting and killing animals for food, you'll join the millions of people who have decided to leave meat off their plates for good. The link in pro-animal thought between the principle of visibility and ethical action is confirmed by offering through the contemporary logic of mass visibility the celebrity endorsement, a magical, if nicely old-fashioned, figure of clarity. The magic continues as this combination of seeing and ethical awareness, so the hope goes, leads the viewer towards the liberating, maybe even revolutionary membership of an indefinitely large mass movement. Consciousness raised, our participation will not only be permanent, but ethical, for good. It's the ideal trajectory of liberal morality, this, a move from ignorant blindness via moral enlightenment to proper conduct. I think of it as the logic of a revelatory animal politics. Some of its difficulties, however, are suggested by a strange and significant but unremarked moment in Jacques Derrida's otherwise conspicuous indictment of animal slaughter in his essay, The Animal That Therefore I Am. Immediately succeeding what can only be called his gothic portrayal of, quote, the artificial, infernal, virtually interminable survival of animal species, quote, exterminated by means of their continued existence in the meat industry, Derrida writes, I don't wish to abuse the ease with which one can overload with pathos the self-evidences I'm drawing attention to here. Everybody knows what terrifying and intolerable pictures a realist painting could give to the industrial, mechanical, chemical, hormonal and genetic violence to which man has been submitting animal life for the past two centuries. Everybody knows what the production, breeding, transport and slaughter of these animals has become. Leaving aside the contradiction here of McCartney's notion that the truth of animal slaughter remains somehow obscure, everybody knows it, Derrida says, one might find a very arresting set of performative utterances at work in Derrida's painting of a picture by describing its redundant non-existence, and in his providing a raft of evidence for that which he says is self-evident. How indeed can it be that one would need to draw attention to things that are self-evident? If, quote, everybody knows these self-evident things, then why is Derrida saying them? Rather than affirm a simple truth regarding what everyone, including crucially his audience as he gave this talk, knows about animal slaughter, doesn't this set of statements work, rather, to bring into some kind of relief everyone's already knowing, while not obviously doing anything, about animal slaughter? And what might be the relation between this asserted general knowledge about the facts and intolerable terror imagined but not actually affected by the pathetic images that could but don't appear in Derrida's non-existent painting? Finally, why does Derrida use this echoing formulation, everybody knows, which suggests an accusation designed to provoke shame in our having that knowledge, even if this shame consists in a kind of bland and apathetic tolerance of the awful, as those most attuned to Leonard Cohen's famous use of the phrase would expect. Everybody knows, that's how it goes, everybody knows. For Derrida, at the very least, then, there is a convoluted relation between facts, evidence, knowing, and disavowal on the one hand, and truth, recognition, admission on the other. And this complexity is delineated via troubled reflection on realistic visibility. For Derrida, such an easily looked at realistic painting, say of Animal Slaughter, is the converse of the singular encounter he presents in his essay with his cat who looks at him. Realistic portrayals of Animal Slaughter, he might say, beg to be looked at, granting their viewers the power to respond in a way that makes them feel self-assured, thinking, I know myself, I know my humanity in my outrage at this picture. Or to turn away and disavow. I know this goes on, but I don't have to concern myself with it because I am different from the animal suffering. Derrida is suggesting a link between disinterest and disavowal as kinds of humanist detachment. Neither of these allows human complicity and violence to be called for later account. Derrida's project is to bring into the open a profound shame that undergirds such human self-assurance. It's a crucial argument of his essay that is rarely remarked. He really thinks that the history of philosophy, and indeed the very idea of philosophy as what he terms the autobiography of the human, are inextricable from a primary shame that attends the emergence of the idea of the human. This autobiographical project, all of the writing and the research that goes on in humanities departments all over the world, this autobiographical project is predicated on a sense of shame. There is something not quite good enough about humans. There is something lacking about them that just isn't lacking about animals. The human exceptionalism of possessing this or that unique capacity is all a lot of protesting too much for Derrida. This shame, which for him cannot go away as long as the human remains in place as a category, could only be brought into the open by singular, that is, non-conceptualizable and non-conceptualized events in which you see yourself seen by another animal. You are thus called to account by that animal, rather than just looking at that animal. The animal is not revealed to you by sight, you are revealed to yourself through its eyes. Hence realism, and the very similar revelation of the world that it offers, somehow ethically fails, because it cannot activate or avow the shame alluded to in that phrase, everybody knows. Taking the lead from this Gothic term in Derrida's representation of animal agriculture then, I'm working towards a type of position in which we are principally aware of the fraught relation between ethical action on the one hand and, on the other, a complex of ideas contrasting visibility, knowledge, and goodness with their dark alternatives, the unseen, the disavowed, the shameful. Such is the quintessential environment of the literary Gothic. It is then a perfect region in which to explore the politics of species and the politics of literary representation in a book I think of as the contemporary masterpiece of pro-animal Gothic, Michel Faber's novel Under the Skin, first published in 2000. This is a difficult book to introduce quickly. I'm imagining that many of you won't have read it, so I'm going to try and offer my analysis of it, bringing bits of the plot in, so there are some spoiler alerts galore. Yeah. It's a difficult book to introduce quickly because the plot summary necessarily spoils a crucial element of the book, which is its gradual revealing that it is a story about one set of beings who call themselves human, who catch, process, kill, and eat another set of beings that they call animals. The twist is that the first set of beings is from another planet, and the eaten ones are the race we usually call humans. That said, an introductory sketch of Under the Skin is as follows. It's set in the rural north and east of Scotland. There's an example basically on the latitude of where we are now, I think. Weather very similar to today, almost every day of the year. It's set in rural and north and eastern Scotland and is narrated principally in the third person in a characteristic mode of literary Gothic that might be called selective omniscience. It seems as if we are being told everything and can trust what we are told to be true, but actually the novel is tied to the consciousness of a youngish woman named Isserly, made-up name, and it shares her prejudices. It's fundamentally the story of Isserly's moral development. Her strangely sibilant name, Isserly, is a good example of Faber's planting of genre effects in rich linguistic soil. Invented languages are a classic science fiction trope, but her alien-sounding name suggests literally that Isserly is simultaneously both empowered and unhappy. She is surly, which, to cite the Oxford English Dictionary, means both imperious and gloomily morose, said of persons or animals. Further, the name's echo of Edward Waverley, the hero of Sir Walter Scott's series of romantic novels, holds out the possibility that Isserly might be, like Waverley, some kind of colonial interloper, whose allegiance will shift towards the Highland people she is amongst. Indeed, the story of a troubled foreign power seen gradually dissolving is more or less an accurate description of the book's narrative and ethical arc. Isserly owes her presence in Scotland to Vess Industries, an agribusiness run from her unnamed home, we presume it's another planet, only seeing brief glimpses through Isserly's memory. The environment there has scarce physical resources, and its society is stratified into at least two groups: the elite, who live in contemporary luxury above ground, and those consigned to live and work in, quote, the new estates, somehow manufacturing the environmental resources for the elite above. In the form of what is, in effect, a neo-colonial outsourcing of resource depletion, Vess Industries has set up an enterprise on Earth in Scotland to provide the elite with the exceptional delicacy of meat, which is termed in the book Vodicin, which is culled from earthly humans who are disparagingly known as Vodsels. The term human is reserved in Isserly's language for what are perceived as her race of people. Having undergone difficult reconstructive surgery to appear inconspicuous amongst the Vodsels, the animals on Isserly's planet are sort of stunning fox or wolf-like shapes, exceptionally handsome-seeming animals, or humans, as they call themselves. She's undergone surgery, including an adaptation from being four to two-legged. Isserly's job is to drive the Scottish roads, picking up protein-rich male hitchhikers. The whole process is a travesty of the ethical relationship of hospitality. Here's a picture. The book was recently filmed with Scarlett Johansson in Isserly's role, but there's basically no animals anywhere in the film. It's still a good film, though. The whole process is a travesty of the ethical relationship of hospitality. The lone hitchhiker's outstretched thumb perfectly emblematizes their abandonment, weakness, and need. But rather than awaken generosity, these occasion the darkest parody of agricultural development and human connection with nature. Isserly stings the Vodsels with drunk needles hidden in the passenger seat of her car, rendering them unconscious. She then takes them to a processing plant that is run underground, disused and apparently innocuous Ablach Farm. The only woman involved in the enterprise, Isserly is routinely met as she arrives by the male staff, eager for her to, quote, deliver the goods. And they extract the sort of insensate Vodsel from the car, which is thus portrayed as a kind of necrotic wound because she's delivering pun and deliver. And the pun and deliver highlights a view of Vess Industries meat production as a technologized and destructive parody of the positive ideals of both nativity and freedom. As the novel proceeds, the farm is visited by Amlis Vess, a dilettante but politically radical heir apparent to the Vess Corporation. Fulfilling the role of pro-animal saboteur, he liberates some of the Vodsels from the underground pens, and long sections follow devoted to his discussions with Isserly about the ethics of eating animals. fossils, of course, are animals to them. Ambrose eventually leaves with little his faith in the Enterprise shaken, and her capacity tentatively growing for empathetic, or at least non-murderous, encounters with the fossils. One way of interpreting the animal politics suggested by this plot that has appealed to a number of the book's readers is to take it as a classic reversal of fortune morality tale, in which human readers witness themselves placed in the position of industrially farmed animals, subject to comparable violence and degradation. I want briefly to explain how this interpretation imagines the text to function according to that revelatory animal politics with which I began. Here, the fossils are taken as the key significant fictional objects in the text Politics of Species, that is, they are the ones that carry the most empathic or ethical weight, and Amos's arguments on their behalf function as the moral crux of the book. So I'm offering this as kind of the revelatory political reading, which I'm then going to sort of critique and develop with a sort of more gothic political reading in the rest of the paper. So a crucial moment, for example, Amos meets Isserling in the farmer's kitchen. The scene is a conventional Gothic space, a secluded place of temptation, heightened sensation, and esoteric secretive knowledge. The Mephistophelian chef, whose name is Hillis, is, quote, protective of his gleaming domain, beavering away in it like an obsessed scientist in a humid and luridly lit laboratory. The setting suggests that the question of meat eating might best be understood as a battle between literally carnal and moral knowledge. At precisely the moment that Isserling tastes the flesh offered to her, giving Isipilis a kind of orgasmic release, yes, 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 he says as she tastes it, Amos speaks from the doorway behind her. He says, "You just don't know what you're doing." And he continues, "That meat that you're eating is the body of a creature that lived and breathed just like you and me." Isserling responds icily, "Mr. Vess, I doubt there's much similarity between the way you and I live and breathe, let alone between me and my breakfast." It's here that Amos offers the text's eponymous ethical axiom. We're all the same under the skin. The basis of Amos's ethics here is an egalitarian community that extends across species, founded on the basis of life and breathing. Uniting materiality and ethics, he aims to uncover a fundamental and crucially submerged or internal truth, which at the level of ethical recognition, nevertheless requires his revelatory gesture to bring it past Isserling's ignorance and into moral visibility. Amos's animal politics here aim to show that the hierarchy of species at play in the text, in which Isserling and her fellow humans perceive themselves as different both in kind and in status from the fossils, relies on a difference that is perceived to be fundamental between their race and the fossils, but which is actually superficial and therefore false. Amos, as a fossil activist, is thereby able to undermine it through his egalitarian political manoeuvre. At the broader level of narrative plot, the reader is guided through a process in which the principles that license the killing and eating of humans are finally undermined on the basis of bodily physicality. We're all the same under the skin. This literary political method, you might say, defamiliarizes anthropocentrism. It draws attention to an ethics of similarity via the organizing irony of an allegory in which humans as fossils are referenced for animals as livestock, revealing that all animals, both human and non-human, are potentially subject to incarceration, killing, and consumption, potentially subject to it. The text ironically reverses conventional species relationships. Here, a similarity that spans the species divide is brought into the light and made apprehensible by a formal strategy known as a novum. that created classic science fiction strategy, the creation of effective world conditions in which there exist aliens that can set up a slaughterhouse for human meat. In this revelatory reading, Under the Skin acts as a form of counter-ideological making visible. It reveals the conceptual false logics which maintain human exceptionalism. These work by instituting a hierarchical difference where there is no ontological difference. We're all physically subject, potentially subject to being eaten. We're all made of meat. That's the ontological similarity, which is displaced by a political hierarchy in which humans can eat animal meat, but animals aren't supposed to eat human meat. That's the logic that's been deconstructed here. A modernist literary strategy of estrangement, defamiliarization, and de-automatization is applied to the perception of species difference. Something that's by conventional not morally visible, the subjection of suffering of non-humans through farming and slaughter, becomes so by virtue of a symbolic allegory in which the reference of the progressive politics is excavated from beneath the surface of the text. So that's the revelatory reading of how the book might work as an allegory. We ought to return, however, to Isserly's reaction to Amos's argument about species equality being grounded in different beings' living and breathing similarity under the skin. She calls it Amos's, quote, filthy rich idealists' need to deny social reality. The basis of her rejection of this idea is her insistence on a basic difference between her and Amos in terms of social power, something which she feels precludes any consideration of a Vodzol as morally significant, such that the Vodzol is completely reduced to its functionality as her breakfast. This moment, the moment where Amos says that Vodzols and humans are all the same under the skin, is foreshadowed by one other use in the novel of the phrase under the skin a few pages earlier. In the derelict cottage in which Isserly lives, away from the main farm buildings and without mains, power, or lighting, Isserly reflects on what she thinks of as the grudging domestic arrangements that were made for her arrival at Ablack Farm. Her mood significantly darkening in this unlit environment, she wonders if this is, quote, an example of her being exploited, used like a piece of brute equipment. A form of treatment, of course, which she avoids by displacing it onto Vodzols. As her memory clears, she realises, however, that this isolation was in fact chosen by her to avoid the patronising attentions of the men, the other men. She's the only woman who works on the farm, all the rest are men. This is Isserly, a report of Isserly's thought. Ogling her in fascinated pity, they had ganged up to douche her with reassurance. They would make this cottage a cosy little nest. She was a poor little thing. She must be so upset at how she had been messed about with. Yes, they understood all about that. But she was brave, yes, she was a plucky girl, and they would treat her as if there was nothing odd or ugly about her at all, for she and they were all the same under the skin, weren't they? She told them she wanted nothing from them, nothing. She would do her job, they would do theirs. Faber delicately embeds the key phrase in a layered narrative style. The narrator reports Isserly's thoughts here, but within these, she is narrating her version of the men's words and thoughts to her. We are given to wonder by Isserly's shaky grasp on the past here, though, whether the narration actually offers an unreliable history of those attitudes that nonetheless powerfully shapes Isserly's current thinking. In any case, the men's sympathetic gaze clearly feels oppressive to her. Isserly realises that to these men, she is abject and pathetic. The use of imagery that portrays her as a kind of fledgling bird indicates this clearly enough. Their sense of her is shaped by a perception of her deformed body. Remember, she's had surgery to make her look like one of us, and they think she looks like an animal now. Their sense of her is shaped by a perception of her deformed body as the beast, and providing domestic comfort is their way of compensating for this. Their claim about her equal value under the skin, despite this deformity, emerges then as an expression of pity. Such a feeling offers to extend a more profound ethical community to her that subtends social and physical difference and its dehumanising manifestations on Isolde's body. Isolde, however, bluntly rejects the patriarchal offer of accommodation, demanding instead a minimum of amenities and otherwise to be left alone to fully invest in the work which shapes her subjectivity and sense of self. Isolde's attitude, it should be said, barely conceals a sense of class hatred. Isolde believes that her work is of a different and higher order to theirs, so she drives around picking up the vodsoles, and she's the only one that can do that. They're kind of menial labourers who process them, so she then creates a class hierarchy between her and them and holds true to that. And so she believes her work is of a different and higher order to theirs, and as such ensures her status. Equally, it's important to interpret Isolde's resistance to the pity expressed here as a complex part of her own resistance to subjection and victimisation. Not only has she rejected an egalitarian form of community expressed as an act of sympathy by other members of her species, her memory also locates the responsibility for that rejection in the men's patriarchal exploitativeness of her. Given that this is how she responded to men she considers her social inferiors, it's not surprising that these convolutions of psychology and senses of personal empowerment and disempowerment also shape Isolde's disparaging reaction to Amos's arguments in favour of universal equality under the skin. Indeed, they significantly undermine the apparently incontrovertible egalitarian message of Amos's comments. In terms of the text's animal politics here, Faber is testing out opposing attitudes to the ethics of compassion in a hierarchically stratified world. To whom can we show, and whom do we definitely owe feelings of sympathy, and why? For whom should compassion be prioritised, if it can be prioritised, and where is it absolutely demanded? Which principles and what feelings determine the requirement for, and which delimit, merciful behaviour? Such questions reflect the two-way relation between currents of feeling and notions of community, showing the blurred causality between these ideas and both the violent practices that draw on and sustain them and the ethical positions that resist. In Under the Skin, we find two important complicating factors in this argument, however. There's a paradoxical appeal both on Isolde's side and on Amos's side to a universalist logic and the recognition that universalism may in fact all the more powerfully exclude those who do not fit into its organising field of vision. An example of that would be from the words of Imhotep's words earlier on, that we have a grand rhetoric of the human, of human rights, but it's very easy for that grand and apparently universalist rhetoric to have zones of inhumanity just on its borders, currently right on Europe's borders. So that's the danger with the universalist rhetoric. The politics of feeling necessarily draws on flows of ethical energy that exceed differences between people or beings, taking immanent sensibility as the ground for transcendent moral recognition, which is by definition limitless. Such apparent limitlessness is crucial to the utopian appeal. On the other hand, the anthropocentric distinction of the human, by way of the idea, for example, of having language, solidifies it as a category, which can thus act as a coherent principle of moral recognition. This is an action, for example, in the organising and yet universalist force of the term human in broad appeals to human rights, such as Amnesty International's Protect the Human campaign. In this arrangement of the universal, the category of species carries particular freight, acting as the basis for a politics that is delimited and hence manageable, all humans, but universal, and thus energised by utopian feeling. Anthropocentric universalism thus orders a politics of feeling that is otherwise chaotic, meaning its subjects are prone to moral invisibility. The two sides of the paradox thus define what can be thought of as the central problematic in the politics of species. Does the delimiting principle of species, we are all human, make possible ethical recognition as such? As humans, we can see that we should be good to animals, and thus allow for the basic principles of justice? Or is it a primary injustice to exclude other species from a political community that should, by definition, remain always open to others? When Amos's attempts to convince Italy away from temptation via a general principle of moral enlightenment is stymied, Amos proceeds to invite her on a quintessential Gothic journey to accompany him, quote, down below, down where the vaudevilles are. When she resists, the narrative portrayal of her reasoning is especially telling. She almost choked on her reply, perhaps because of a tiny thread of meat lodged in her throat. Because I'm so scared of the depths, she was thinking, because I don't want to be buried alive again. Because I have work to get on with, she said. It's a singular moment in the novel, the one and only time that the narrative voice seems to become Isserly rather than just describing her. Used sparingly, as here, this technique offers a strong sense that we are gaining a privileged insight into a crucial aspect of this character. What this suggests, I think, is that the radically enlightening, revelatory gesture, can you see that we're all the same under the skin, cannot so quickly dispense with the hierarchical differences of power, the deep psychological effects that these have, and how such effects might occasion or shape moral action. For Amos, echoing Paul McCartney's appeal for the glass wall slaughterhouse, the ethical move to witness what has been forced beneath ground and so to reveal its truth on the basis of the similarity of what is under the skin, for Amos, that's a straightforwardly moral gesture of enlightenment. For Isserly, as the object herself of a hierarchical power that would force her to work in the estates back in her home planet, she's in the Earth in order to avoid that degradation, the very thought of such moral excavation is deeply frightening and traumatic. This is the trauma that she has already found her own way to repress through a full investment in the value of her work. Isserly's life on Earth, indeed, is the result of what Faber quietly hints is a peculiarly Hobbesian kind of bargain struck to avoid the structural inequality of her society. She reflects that coming to Earth required, quote, a very small personal sacrifice, really, avoided a lifetime buried in the estates, a brutishly short lifetime by all accounts. This bargain's double-edged aspect is set out well in one of Isserly's many reflections on viewing Scotland's natural beauty. She looked at the whole wide world from her rocky vantage point on the shore of Arlach Farm. It was unbelievably marvellous. She felt like running about in it forever, except that she couldn't run anymore. Not that she'd have been doing any running in the estates. She'd have been shambling around spiritlessly along with all the other losers of lowlifes in the underground corridors of bauxite and compacted ash. She'd have been working her guts out in a moisture filtration plant or oxygen factory, toiling in filth like a maggot among other maggots. Instead, here she was, free to wander in an unabounded wilderness, swirling with awesome surfaces of air and water. And all she had to do in return, when it came down to essentials, was walk on two legs. There's a lot going on here, and I want to pick out a few key points. The first is the sense in the last line that Isserly's life on Earth has required her to sacrifice the lithe freedom of her four-legged nature. The book is indeed punctuated by repeated descriptions of the continuing physical and mental anguish being suffered by Isserly as a result of her surgery. This picture of a fullness of being that is sacrificed in favour of a life of work is clearly influenced by a Marxist theory of alienation. The image of the living death of the new estates is itself a compelling allegory of the precarious conditions of existence of the underclasses of multinational neo-capitalism. Yet for Italy, the positive outcomes of a bourgeois bargain in which work guarantees both physical comfort and social upward mobility do not and cannot fully compensate for or replace the natural fluidity that she has sacrificed. Indeed, as Italy's mortal fear at the threat of being taken underground to see the vaudeville pens shows, her original alliance with Vest Industries to escape upwards from the hell of life in the new estates is attended by a deep residual fear of being returned to that hell which has escaped, and a paranoiac hatred of those who failed to do so, a sort of moral claustrophobia, you might say. One of the things that's going on with my reading here is that I see in Italy a kind of fictional version of that shame that Derrida was talking about, that I referred to in the opening of the essay, that being human, that living as a human, following the circumscriptions of human life, requires and necessitates a loss of something, and that loss is traumatic, a loss of animal freedom, one's animal freedom, I suppose. One of the most subtle aspects of Isolde's character in the novel is the way that her basic desire for physical comfort, not to be immured in the physical hell of the estates, becomes embroiled with this ethically inflected claustrophobia, because crucially, both are elements of utter vulnerability that potentially unite her with the victimised vaudevilles. The second point I'd note is the way that when it comes to Isolde's understanding of social value, in this quotation, A Discourse of Species is an integral part of her manner of self-definition. In this quotation, her fear is of becoming a maggot like other maggots. But running through the novel is a sense that Isolde's experience as the victim of social exclusion by the elite has resulted in a mortal avoidance of exhibiting what she calls an almost subhuman taint of estate trash, a bestial nature she finds in all of the men who surround her in the enterprise of meat manufacture. The rhetoric of animality here is her way of parsing social value within her species. Finally, this passage displays the Gothic multiplicity of Faber's prose style, in which a language seemingly blank on the surface holds disturbing truths of the plot crypt-like within it. It can only be darkly ironic that Isolde escaped to the job she has to avoid, quote, shambling around spiritlessly in the estates, given the historical meanings of the word shambling. To shamble in English means to cut up or slaughter. A shamble is a table for displaying meat, and the sense of shambling, meaning to walk awkwardly, is likely to derive from the misshapen legs of such tables in the 14th and 15th centuries. Its early usage presumes to be of people like Isolde with impaired legs. The name of the farm, Ablach, is a Scots word for an insignificant person, just as the vaudevilles are for Isolde and her fellow humans. This sense of insignificant person is derived from the original Scots Gaelic meaning of the word Ablach, which is mangled carcass. It's uncannily difficult, Faber seems to suggest, to escape this kind of violence. As we saw with Derrida, Faber's use of the language here places readers in the uncanny and potentially shameful position of simultaneously knowing and not knowing about slaughter. An example that confirms the failure of Isolde's bargain with social stratification is crucial to the text's animal politics. It occurs after a pivotal chapter in which Isolde struggles to defend the treatment of vaudevilles against Amos' questioning, and then is herself subject to a violent assault by a pitch item. Following these events, Isolde's characteristic emotionless demeanour increasingly slips as she loses confidence in the, quote, positive aspects of the bargain, that is, the commitment to work that offers her individuation and self-definition, and the commitment to species exceptionalism that stood as the moral justification of this work. Lacking these, she looks to embrace or experience the violence embedded in meat-making practices as a form of sadistic self-definition. That is, she first rejects Amos's attempt to cast a new moral light where her bargain with power had insisted on the social objection of fossils. Such enlightenment could, theoretically at least, have been a response to the kind of claustrophobic fear of darkness, downwardness, and internality that conditions her life on Earth. Instead, she obsessively seeks to witness the slaughter in the hope, it seems, of re-signifying the dark space in fossil manufacture as a place of nihilistic or sadistic ecstasy in which her pure power is confirmed in a violent envisioning of fossil's pure weakness. However, her emotional or psychic investment is found by the men to be too close for comfort to a form of embodied feeling, empathy, or sympathy that we've seen with Amos. Unser, the chief processor, indicts her precisely for failing to maintain her own erstwhile attitude. He says, "We are doing a job here, feelings don't enter into it." This glimpse that the pure horror of the process is exactly its normality results in a major psychic collapse for Isserly, in many ways the beginning of her rejection of various industries and its species' practices. By the end of the novel, Isserly picks up one last hitchhiker who needs her help to attend the birth of his child at the nearby Mercy Hospital. No longer used to deliver Vodzels to their death, Isserly's car allows him to work, albeit briefly, in favour of compassion and life. To sum up, I've been trying to trace here what I would call, in contradistinction to the revelatory animal politics with which I began, under the skin's gothic animal politics. These consist in its fascination with the repressed aspects of life, the trauma of an always already lost connection to nature. They capture Isserly's permanent exile from her fellows rather than the homeliness, concord, community, agreement, or shared subjective life that is offered by Amos's utopian ideal of interspecies similarity under the skin. Whereas this liberal morality envisions progressive enlightenment towards the ideal of full recognition of all subjects, you know, human rights can just extend outward to animal rights and then everything will be fine. What I'm calling a gothic politics involves tracing, exploring, and bearing witness to the importance of the dark, abject zones of being that are always created by the roots of thought, subjection, empowerment, and impoverishment along which social hierarchy proceeds. In the picture of the elite and the new estates that emblematizes life in Isserly's home world, the book dramatizes those forces of social stratification and coherence that proceeds by parceling out power and sovereignty, and by requiring the dispossession of some in securing the possessions of others. As I suggested, Isserly's presence on Earth is the result of her striking an ontological bargain with capital, I suppose, coming from vast industries, in which she isn't socially abject, but others of her species and beings of the Vodzel species are socially abject. Rather than pretend such attitudes away in the process of moral enlightenment, the novel's gothic literary politics of species recognizes their psychic and material power, their resilience, and their peculiar creative force in forging hierarchical societies. The pro-animal interest of Isserly's story in this reading stems from the fact that it plots her itinerary away from the deal that she has struck with asymmetric power in the hope of avoiding the primary vulnerability that the novel evokes. What then are the literary politics of species that emerge from a reading on this model? Well, they emerge not from overseeing an allegorical pattern in which anthropocentrism is unworked for the reader, based on our tacit identification with the victims of horror, i.e. a presumed human species identity that undergirds the novel's egalitarian political effect. Rather, the reader is asked to accompany the gothic journey of a violent heroine, primarily identifying with her, before coming to terms with the complicitous amoral effect of such fictional identification. This process allows the reader to experience the dangerous effects, and indeed the fallacy, of her complicity with power. We also witness the dismantling of that complicity, the organising and sustaining force of which is the anthropocentric paradigm of Italy's self-alignment with the elite. This was a hierarchy within her animal species, maintained by the species logic that attacks the animals that are humans. Thanks very much.
Sense you can call them processed meat also if you want to. But going back to literature, as we are talking about literature, I think in Dr. McKay's reading, Under the Skin, reveals the processes of subjection and objection inherent in social hierarchies, and thereby providing an important counterpoint to the visions of progressive enlightenment towards the ideal of full recognition of all subjects. And I completely agree with this reading. I think it's a very important reading to make about this book. And I also agree with the stress that McKay puts on the literary strategy of estrangement, as we saw what it can do to conceptions of normality and conceptions of humanity. And well, obviously everybody who knows me knows that I believe that there is a great power in strangeness and estrangement in deconstructing these naturalized conceptions of different entities and different practices also.
That said, if I want to make a more a more particular point, I would like to go back to your discussion on anthropocentric universalism and its sort of paradoxical effects. Mm-hmm. That on the other hand, we have what you call the utopian appeal of sameness. Utopian appeal of interspecies recognition and similarity between our species. And of course, that's what the whole animal rights movement builds on, and that's a very affirmative position to make. You can act from that position. But on the other hand, we have the notion of sameness, of similarity. It orders everything around the human. It orders every other being in terms of humanity. And well, if it's more similar to human, it's of course better. Well, yeah. I want to go back to this one quote you mentioned. The quote where Cicely sarcastically recounts the worker immense desire to help her. Let me find it again. She was brave, yes. She was a plucky girl, but they would treat her as if there was nothing odd or ugly about her. For she and they were all the same on the scheme. Right. She told them she wanted nothing to do with them. Nothing. In this context, used in that sentence, we are all under the skin, of course, seems patronizing, and it does seem even a colonizing gesture. And I think everybody who has done feminist or post-colonialist readings understands the reaction of Cicely to that gesture. That, okay, you are invited to join the club. You are sort of treated as the same, but when the invitation comes from the one holding the high status, they reach a hand to the one with the low status. They're sort of denying everything that's odd and ugly about her. So, and the narrative of Under the Skin continually emphasizes that Isabel's experience of herself is very much based on the oddness and ugliness and the processes that have made her odd and ugly, that cannot be reversed. Really, really, she has been mangled and made in from my perspective, made inhuman. She's been made a monster, in a sense. That's a source of horror for her. So, of course, in that position, the thing that she can do is assert herself as something else, as a worker in her case. That's the case where the value is found. We have to appreciate that, that there's a sense of constructing herself for purposes, for you know, purposes of functioning. But we also have to appreciate that even this reading, I make readings of the character, and well, I don't know the character, and I don't really, well, of course, know anything else but that than the text. I always construct a character, and then depends on my strategy of reading what kind of a character I find there. And well, it goes back to the idea of either, you know, the utopian sameness reading or the estranging reading. And well, the choice between those two is also strategic. If you read for sameness, you find sameness. And then your whole world seems secure, so, and still human shaped. But if you go for the estranging reading, you have to pay sort of closer attention to detail. And this sort of reading is, I think, also very much encouraged by the book itself, as it uses perspective so much. It uses point of view. Most of the time we are obviously in Isley's perspective, but then it's continuously contrasted with the perspectives of the hitchhikers, who are a variety of different men, and their styles of thought and styles of attention are, you know, written in various ways. And they see different things in Isley also. The very visual aspects of Isley's character are, you know, portrayed differently. And well, most of them, well, it's a very odd routine that they fall into. They all assess each other. Well, Isley assesses them as potential, you know, sources of meat, and well, most of the teachers also assess her as a potential catch, or potential sexual partner, or potential whatever. And not always, it breaks. That sort of conception also breaks with the novel. Towards the end, there is this one teacher who never talks. He just sees all the scars in his body and all the points of oddness there. And his perspective is very precise. But they do not establish a connection because he does not talk. And well, Isabel ends up killing him, because she just loses patience with the mute, and with all the men, anyway. And I think that's a very interesting point, an interesting, you know, turn in the novel. Because it sort of, it underlines the, you know, the gap between perspectives and the you know, power of literature to present different perspectives. And as we as readers can take all those perspectives, all the perspectives of all the hitchhiking characters and history, we see that okay, there is profound misunderstanding and a lack of communication between them. But but they still establish some. There are moments of connection across that gap of strangers, across difference, that I think are very interesting. And I think that's what we might be doing here also, if I want to suddenly take this up to a general level and address you as people who come from very different approaches. But, well, we have developed critical perspectives to things that are very, very different from each other. We are strangers to each other in more than one sense. But if we keep that strangeness in mind, we might be able to pay more attention to what are they communicating, well, either by words or by something else. Well, that's a very lofty point to make, but. Mm-hmm. I think I should open this up for your questions and comments also. That's what I got out of your talk, and I very much appreciate it.
Yeah,
thank you.
actually the difficulties and misunderstandings that constantly are at play, and attending carefully to those is one of the most crucial aspects of the work that, that we can do in the humanities, I think, rather than a sort of drive towards recognition and the belief that everyone might be able to fully communicate. Mm. You know, so that's great.
Okay, so now if we have audience questions, we have Yanni there with the microphone.
Thank you, a very interesting talk. I'm a sort of an interdisciplinary scholar presenting the next session, and it's interesting you, what you mentioned about the abusive animal video, and that whoever it was, I guess the reporter, said that if they were in the place of the employees, that they would have been doing essentially the same thing. You know, that the context is to blame more than the actual person, much more so. The person is intrinsically abusive, the context makes them so. This claim was made by more than one person a couple of centuries ago during slavery in the United States, and by actually one of the slaves herself, Mary Prince, is the one I'm thinking of. I'm sure others said something quite similar. I think it's worth considering, I don't know how many people do anything like slave scholarship, that the parallels are quite terrifying, actually, but also very important when you consider things like animal politics, and the distinction between human and non-human, and that this struggle has been fought before on sort of different ideologies and different planes, and the arguments that have been gone through are surprisingly parallel. My slight worry, more than slight, is that history has allow these kinds of things to get forgotten to the point that we can't make parallels as intrinsically as we'd like to. And so I would then sort of ask this as a question. To the extent that, I think you touched on it, I can't remember fully, that notion of our own sort of complicitness for all, everybody in here, no matter what you eat, in terms of the process that the food goes through, just because we don't think about it, or frankly are not allowed to think about it by the consumer economy. How does that come into play in Under the Skin in your reading of it?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I mean, I think that the kind of parallels, I like the word parallel for these two, to bring those the issue of other human political situations and the animal question. And I like the word parallel rather than say analogy, because it suggests that they might run in, along similar lines, but they're necessarily different also. You see what I mean? That there are peculiar questions and issues around slavery that aren't relevant in terms of animal ethics, but there are some similarities. And I think that I didn't explicitly bring it out because I think the book doesn't offer too many ways to see that particular parallel, although one I think is important, which I touched on, which was that pun on the word deliver. So when Italy delivers the vodsels, and it's ironically commenting on the way that we might think of a society providing meat for its citizens in this kind of maternal, in heavy inverted commas, way. But within that, the word deliver is hugely important in stories of emancipation of slaves in the 19th century. And there is a kind of this deliver because of the Christian rhetoric around deliverance from evil and things. And the book is sort of punning on that, so it is there. And I think that the connections are important, but I personally just don't have the skills or the knowledge, particularly about the slavery context, to say very much useful about that, because I think I want to know more, to do careful attention to the differences. One thing I would say is that one parallel that I see is just the obvious one that, that civil rights legislation in the 60s that does away with segregation or these kinds of things doesn't create an equal society. It creates a rhetoric around equality, a rhetoric around freedom and all the sameness, which can very easily obscure massive material differences and political economic ones. And I think that that's one of the reasons that's driving me to query and just complicate the liberal ideal of animal rights, because I think that it dangerously can, you know, while I share its ethical commitments, it dangerously overlooks the psychological and political economic challenges in achieving anything that would even look like animal rights. I don't know if that's an answer to your question. Do you want to comment?
Well, to the last point, actually, what the animal rights movement does is also sort of infantilizes the animal and everything else that isn't the same, really.
Yeah.
That's something that might actually be relevant to the slavery discussion also, that we have to save them. Anyway, let's someone else.
Yeah, thank you both of you, Dr. McKay and Vice Gordico, for the fine comments. Both of you made a point about the hierarchy of power, which I think is very important, and I don't think so. Quite a few reviews sort of seem to have missed that. They think about the alien view, possibly through Glaser's film, and they forget about that. Actually, what I feel that Faber is trying to tell us in terms of what Kaiser just said about, you know, trying to take it onto another level, what he's trying to tell us through the allegory is that if we think in terms of class, leads to racialism. Racialism leads to racism, and racism leads to speciesism. In other words, if you think hierarchically in those sort of senses, they all go together. And one thing that you didn't think mention and take sort of the novel to another level, or you mentioned it possibly in passing, was the fact that Isily is, of course, absolutely in awe of the beauty of Earth, and her own planet has been absolutely destroyed, and the life there is really straight from H.G. Wells's Time Machine, two different species living, you know, one above the Earth and the other sort of workers below the Earth. And of course, that's a warning for pollution. So there are so many things going on in the novel that I feel that it's such a rich one.
No, I agree totally. And I think the thing that I think the novel insists on within that, or the challenge that the novel insists that we attend to within that kind of logic that you explained there, is how that it's not possible to return to some kind of benign connection with nature. So that the quotation that I had of where Isily is looking at the beauty of nature, and she realizes that she can only appreciate this sublime nature because she is traumatically denaturized. So she's caught in this always already distinctness from her own nature in order to be able to access or see this beautiful human nature. And to be honest, I think that I don't know where Faber is eventually going with this argument, because there's the implicit structure, the tacit structure in the novel it essentially is post-Anthropocene in the sense that it doesn't offer us any possibility of a world that human beings might live happily in ecologically. It's just not an option. It's because Isily is the avatar for the human in the book. So Isily is us. She's an anthropocentric humanist, and she has necessarily left her connection with her true nature behind. So it's sort of post-Anthropocene in that way. And I think that, like many critical novels that are trying to critically analyse a sort of social logic, it has a utopian hope, but it is not able to imagine within the text what that utopian hope would look like, you know, what the world of post-anthropocentric humans would be like, you know, how would we live, how would you relate to animals, how would you feed yourself? You know, these kinds of questions the book hasn't got to working out yet, I don't know if that's an answer to your question, but to me it's an unresolved challenge in the book. As the novel sort of comes to an end, there's, you know, Isserly stops hunting, she ditches Bess Industries, and she's sort of trying to work out what she's going to eat. And she doesn't know what she's going to eat, but she sees, you know, fields with turnips in them, and she thinks, oh, the sheep eat them, maybe I can eat them. But then, you know, it's not going to work.
It becomes sort of absurd. She also goes and forages, fuel stations.
Yeah.
Tesco is made the essential place of human nature.
Yeah, yeah.
She fears the supermarket.
Yeah.
Because that's where the humans reside, really.
Yeah.
That's
that's why the book has this dark, pessimistic ending where there just is no future for Isserly. No, it's really very pessimistic. The problem, and this is the problem with the egalitarian ideal too, is that there's a car crash at the end, and Isserly realizes that no matter how she might decide to like Vodzels, you know, as soon as some Vodzels find this alien, you know, what's going to happen to her? They're not going to take her to a hospital and, do emergency surgery on her. They're going to quickly find that she's not a human, and she's going to end up in some, you know, scientific station getting experimented on. So that's the limit of the egalitarian ideal, I think, that she's... So the book is pessimistic in those kinds of ways.
It's a tiny hope in the fact that the mercy hospital. I think that's the point. He doesn't want to show us the utopian ideal.
Yeah.
He wants to show us, what's happening right now. You know, this is a kind of view of humanity.
I agree, and I think that his utopianism is also gendered too, so that the book ends with Isserly helping someone get to the birth of a child. And then there's virtually no women in the book except Isserly, so she sees one in the distance on about page 150, and then the next woman that we see is a woman who comes to help her when she's had this car crash. And so the book ends with this, you know, it has a sort of second wave feminist sort of quality at the end, where a feminized ethic appears. Which I've not fully thought through. It's certainly that's where the hint of utopia is, I agree.
Do I have time for a quick question? Oh, okay. I was thinking about the example of Demerina, about one seeing oneself through cat's eyes, and you were also talking about if something is morally visible or unseen or visibility. I thought that's maybe quite an anthropocentric way to perceive things.
Okay.
I mean, vision and sight, they are so central for us humans. So should we, in the era of post-human movements, instead talk about how we smells oneself through cat's nose or something like that?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think that you make a good point. I think it's one that Derrida is working towards, and is that he's trying to deconstruct the idea that only humans can actively see, and that animals can be seen but don't do seeing themselves. So he's a classic Derridean move to deconstruct the systematic that we are currently in, rather than imagine an entirely other systematic. But in terms of its the anthropocentrism, or maybe better, the humanism of sight, you know, that's, I think, runs right through the novel, and where its Gothic logic becomes important is that Isserly has this paranoiac fear of darkness and the underground and night and these kinds of things. And Amelis offers her enlightenment, light. You know, he wants to open things up to sight. But what becomes absolutely clear is within the novel is that there just isn't that straightforward correction of her sensibility. It's just not available. And so I think the novel is very aware that we'll never get to a world where everything can be happily and perfectly seen. I mean, to come back to the question around sort of meat production, for example, I mean, I think that better oversight of things so that you can regulate them properly and carefully and things aren't going on hidden in the dark. That was the dream of post-war animal welfare campaigners. And one of the things that it does result in is beautifully clean and perfectly ordered and reasonable slaughterhouses, where there's an excellent and swift progression of the animals through them without any messing about and chasing them haphazardly, as you so beautifully put it. So that's one of the challenges with enlightenment, is that enlightenment leads to certain kinds of good things. You don't see the haphazardness, which looks horrible when you see an unfinished documentary. But what you get instead is more pigs getting processed through. So I think you're right to raise the question of sight, I think, is absolutely central to the book. I think Derrida's aware of that and aware that, you know, the enlightenment reason is not going to bring us to any kind of sort of post-humanist understanding of the world.
Okay, thank you, both of you. I think we have to continue now. So next we will have a coffee break and we will continue 12:15 for our sessions. And they're in the F building, right? Okay, thank you.